Support for the Media Project comes from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a new Bachelor of Science degree in public health with a focus on social, physical, and behavioral sciences. strose.edu. From Northeast Public Radio, this is the Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk. Pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
The Media Project is underway, an opportunity for a half hour of commentary, analysis, and perhaps even a little insight into the news media issues of the week. I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union in Albany. Sitting next to me, Ira Fussfeld, the publisher emeritus now of the Daily Freeman in Kingston, New York.
Hello, sir. Rex. Nice to see you back.
Wonderful to see you. A longtime sports writer he was before he turned into a city editor, before he turned into an editor, before he turned into a publisher.
Now I've turned into a retired person, and I feel a lot better about life.
Well, I'm very glad to hear that. It would do that. Dr. Alan Shartok is at the end of the table down there, the CEO of Northeast Public Radio. Let's see. We could do your career trajectory, too.
What do you want to know?
Not much anymore.
Lifelong professor, right?
Yes.
Worked a little bit with the New York City Police Department, the police commissioner down there.
Which side were you on?
I was on the side of good. I was on the side of good against bad.
Lock him up, boys.
But it was a long, long time ago. And our friend Frank Serpico and others were, that was the time they were all very active, you know, in the department. And then I went on to be a professor, started at Rutgers, the Eagleton Institute. Then went to, I'm so glad you asked me about
that. What about you, Rex? New person in your class at Columbia.
When Serpico first emerged as a force, how did the news media treat him? Was the notion that there was corruption in the police department accepted in the mainstream media in New York City?
In fact, the New York Times was all over it. Mm-hmm. They really sort of led the way, you know, on doing that. I'm sure our friend Frank would not agree that they did enough, but they did plenty. The real question is how much, Rex, was really going on? In other words, I've heard from people when I was there that every time they turned over a rock, they found corruption.
Mm-hmm.
Now, was it like the war in Vietnam? You know, we'll leave and we'll declare victory.
Uh-huh. Right.
Because there was a real push for a while. Then there was the Knapp Commission, and Knapp was not, he was a guy who has always been portrayed on Law and Order as a hard beep, and who, you know, who just was impossible with everybody. And then all of a sudden, there was no more.
Yeah. So you just don't turn over those rocks, and so you don't see the creepy crawly things underneath.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. Although I have to say, here in Albany, I just heard a story yesterday that somebody said that the cops come into a particular restaurant that they go to, and even if it's offered on the cuff, they won't take it. They'll put some money down on the counter.
I think there is a different culture nowadays. Yeah. And that may well be in particular in the Albany Police Department. I don't know the rest of the world. But
we don't know if there's a big difference, for example, between Albany and Schenectady.
Who knows? So anyway, here we are. Shadow knows. Yeah, so we're in an interesting situation. We ought to give credit where it is due at the top to Governor Andrew Cuomo, who has signed a bill that is a bit of good news on the Freedom of Information Law, because we are routinely criticizing officials for covering up. We've made a big deal out of this, but there's
And him in
particular,
for
right?
Not, you know, having to make people wait and wait and wait and wait. So what's this all about?
Well, it's a little fix, but it could be significant in some cases. It's a bill that is a substantial improvement in the way that things go in the state Freedom of Information Law. So right now, the way it goes, government agencies have 9 months to appeal a judge's order. That is, if a judge says, yep, you've got to turn over that documentation, the state can still wait 9 months, and on the last day of that 9 months, they finally file their appeal to the next higher court. in effect, just stopping the release of information for as long as the human gestation period to hope that another higher court can overturn it. Now, this new law that the governor signed gives them just 60 days. So the state, which already, you know, before you even get to court, there have been usually years of efforts, litigation to get to that. So at least it shortens the time span.
Big spiel. I mean, think about it for a second, Rex. When your guys call up, or Ira, when your guys were calling up and asking for something that was for an article for the next day, and they were being put off and being told, you know, sorry, we're going to have to get that together or we're not going to do it. So there's always the story behind the story. This is not a show about politics. But here you get a guy like Andrew Cuomo who is under tremendous strain because obviously his closest allies and friends are up on serious felony charges. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, I think we're seeing a sweeter, more docile Andrew Cuomo than we used to. So this is the kind of thing which allows, and the newspapers have to analyze it, and get somebody to say what they don't want to say themselves in a news article. They walk up to, you know, Jerry Benjamin or Alan Chartok or somebody and say, what do you make of this? And then they get somebody, it's my theory of the F sharp. They get somebody to play the F sharp for them. But I suspect a lot of that is what's going on right now.
So what's the catch? When I heard about this, I'm cynical enough to wonder why he did this. It certainly is a big improvement over what it was. You're suggesting perhaps that it's a good offensive move for him to make, and given what may be going on around him. And although the law did pass both houses of the legislature, as I understand it, it still does not apply to the legislature
itself.
That's
it. That's exactly what the answer to your question is. What's the catch? The catch is that this enables everybody to say, well, we've done something for FOIL. Let's not make any other changes to FOIL right now, including, number one, the legislature is not subject to the Freedom of Information Law. Legislature spends $200 million a year. We'd like to know how that's being spent, and they have exempted themselves. Number two, there's been a long-time effort that will be renewed again in the next legislative session to toughen the law so that judges shall give legal fees to people who prevail in cases where public officials, without any good justification for it, withhold information. Now judges may, and usually they don't. But this would toughen it so that more frequently the state would end up having to pay if they have illegally withheld documents. And that has been held up for a long time. So maybe the catch is that having done something nice on the Freedom of Information Law, now the governor doesn't have to do anything for a couple years.
That's a possibility. The other possibility is Preet Bharara is out there. He's been indicting people around Cuomo, and Cuomo has to appear to look like he's a reformer.
This could be. Here we have a piece of mail, by the way, from a reader named Jean, who says, great discussion today on Trump's bullying of the media. Now the focus needs to be on the dynamics of bullying. Is bullying an American value? Look at how Fox News sets an example and instructs its audience to use bullying of liberal guests as acceptable discourse. The Apprentice teaches bullying, too. Report on how Fox is setting up the token liberal, taunting, name-calling, overpowering by ganging up on. Of course, you know, the conservative commentators are kind of tokens on the other channels, don't you think? I think it works both ways there.
Yeah, okay, but Rex, the point about bullying is very good. If the president-to-be of the United States is going around bullying people, and we know that, you know, bullying is often regarded as name-calling, right, Ira? You know, you call somebody fat, or you call somebody crazy, or you call somebody short. That's the kind of thing that we see going on from a president. And now there's a spate of bullying all over the United States that we find the signal is on. All wraps are off. Go ahead and bully.
Well, it's not only bullying, it's lying. Hmm. I mean, we're seeing, and Trump has just become the expert. He hasn't just become because his life's history is being a liar and an exaggerator. And now look what happened. He got elected president of the United States. So are the youth of America going to be following his example to somebody to look up with? This is not exactly George Washington saying he cut down the cherry tree.
Oh, I've noticed here at WAMC, where we do lots of programming, I've noticed more troll bullying than I have ever seen before. You know, so it's happening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you have to be on top of it. You have to report that kind of incident as stories.
Well, it's not I'm going to kill you. It's that you're a jerk.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. What do you both think about, I think the phrase that's been popularized is ambush journalism, and I'm thinking, I'm going to give you two examples. One is the Mike Wallace 60 Minutes kind, which I believe was widely heralded at the time because he went off after these transgressors and put them in embarrassing situations. Now, forgive me, but I happen to, as we sit here, last night watch a little of Fox News, and Jesse Waters, who is, I find, a despicable guy, is frequently on O'Reilly. They were doing a story about flag burning, and there is now, in the wake of Trump's suggestion about flag burners lose their citizenship, there are now protests popping up where people are burning the flag. And I missed some of the detail, but at a college somewhere in New England, there is a flag controversy that the president of the college has sided with the protesters.
And
Hampshire College. Mm-hmm. And Jesse Waters literally went to the president's house to meet him as he got out of his car in his garage and followed him to the point where he was holding his foot in the door because the president wouldn't answer his questions. Do we admire that kind of ambush journalism in the same way that we admired Mike Wallace's? Or is the distinction, it depends on what your ideology?
I don't think it's ideology. I think it's a distinction of what kind of information you're seeking. The president of a private college has no ultimate responsibility to respond to a specific reporter on a specific question. That is, I don't think that the president of Hampshire College has to talk to this reporter, and I think it's actually rude. You know, we try to make appointments with people, but we don't go to people's homes unless there is a situation where we have had someone who has absolutely withdrawn from every opportunity for us to get a comment from them on a matter of genuine public interest. So it's all judgment. You know, a lot of journalism is judgment. It's a lot about human values. I'm not much for gotcha journalism. That is, when a public official kind of stumbles over a word or something or somewhat misstates mm-hmm. what they really think, I think we ought to give them the benefit of the doubt to say, wait a minute, what did he really say here?
Was Mike Wallace and now Jesse Waters, are they bullies?
I think there's some degree of bullying there. I've never been a great fan either of Mike Wallace's ambush journalism.
Yeah.
It's a different matter if you have a Secretary of Defense who refuses to speak with reporters, and so you go chasing after that person to try to find him as he's coming out of the office. I still don't think even then you go to the Secretary of Defense's home, because there is something to be said about preserving some modicum of privacy for public officials.
Well, now that you mention it, let's go to the T word for a moment. And that is
Trump,
here's
that
Donald
word?
Trump, right, yeah. Announcing that, you know, his wife and his kid are going to continue to live in Trump Tower, which is in the 50s on Fifth Avenue, along with Tiffany's and every other major store that's there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, on January 21st, there is going to be a march in New York City
mm-hmm.
in which people are going to march from Herald Square to Trump Tower. And they're going to be there. And that's the end of Fifth Avenue for that particular day. And maybe there'll be other people out there. And I had a very interesting fellow, J.P. Miller, on who does the Empire Report aggregation. And he's sort of to the right of center. And he was saying, well, yeah, we can't have that. We can't have the traffic stacked. So let's put them in Central Park. Let's put the protesters in Central Park. Now, you know, there is a First Amendment. There is a guaranteed right. Trump knows that if he lives in Trump Tower, there are going to be protests out there. There are protests outside of the White House, right? They may mm-hmm. be across the street in Lafayette Square, but there are protests.
Yes, and and it's up to the police to maintain order, and but the police give a parade permit, right, in this case, so that New York City is able to function. So people have a right to protest. They have a right to offer their point of view. That's a little bit different from the journalism ethics. I mean, there's no question there's a right of this guy to ask whatever question he wants to the president. It's just a question of journalism ethics. What's the right thing to do?
Now, whose program did you guys say he was on all the time?
O'Reilly.
O'Reilly. Yeah. Now, O'Reilly every year has gone after my little town of Great Barrington.
Speaking of bullies.
Right?
Yeah, speaking of bullies. Why? Because for a couple of years, they didn't have any money and they didn't put up holiday, let's just say holiday lights.
Oh, the war against Christmas.
Give
me a break.
And this became a big thing. And this year, I was talking to the Rotary Club the other day, and they announced that they were putting up the holiday decorations on the flagpoles and everything else, and then the phone poles and everything else. I was annoyed with them because I don't like to give in to bullies.
Well, you know, this war against Christmas is something that was a fabrication of Fox News, quite frankly.
Specifically O'Reilly.
10 years ago, yeah, a dozen years ago. And I used to get complaints because we run an annual Christmas card contest. The children in the community and all of our schools around here make holiday cards, and we pick winners in each grade category, K through 12, and then I pick a grand prize winner, and that gets to be the front page of the Times Union, front page piece of art on Christmas Day.
Wow.
And people were very upset because one of the winners we picked once was not a religious theme. There have been times when instead of saying Merry Christmas, we've said Happy Holidays. You know, we have a multicultural society here. We're a pluralistic community. We can't be just purely religious. So it is really one of these interesting dilemmas, and we in the media get caught in the middle of it because we have to reflect the realities. I do think, however, Christmas is Christmas. When you say Merry Christmas, that is not, even though the name Christ is in Christmas, Christmas has become a secular holiday as well as a religious one. And so I don't really think that there's anything religious in saying Merry Christmas to someone.
Well, there are many who would disagree with you, of course.
I understand.
And, you know, I understand why people get annoyed with this, but some people get annoyed whenever they can.
That's right. Absolutely. Back to, you know, Ira raised an interesting issue. What do you do about a president, which we're going to have now, a president who frankly, flagrantly disregards the facts all the time. And it's been shown to be the case that he does. Voters didn't care about that. They voted for him anyway.
Some voters.
Right, 47% of
the voters. Well, we don't know whether they didn't care about it. There certainly were some, we think, who didn't care about it. But I'm wondering whether there are as many who just didn't know he wasn't telling the truth. They just believed him.
There were thousands of Muslims in New Jersey cheering the falling towers.
Well, that's one of many.
But he always, the beauty of this guy, and I say that with real disdain, the beauty of this guy is he always picks things that he thinks will excite people and that'll
flag
put him
burning,
on the right
for example.
Side. Flag burning is a great example.
Settled law since 1990, really, and he brings it back into the mainstream conversation.
Right, or millions of illegal voters.
Yeah.
Or Muslims. I mean, you know, there may be some people in this country who don't like them. I am not one of them. I think it's great that we have a diverse country. But nevertheless, he does pick those things. And if he tells a whopper about them, who's going to care?
Well, he's shown that he can pretty much get away with it with impunity. He's also shown, I'm hesitant to give him this much credit for being this smart, but he sees if he's getting bad press on a particular topic, he tweets out something even more controversial to distract the attention.
Sure.
And that he knows that in 24 hours, they'll be on to something else.
That's been
the history of his campaign.
Right, you are. So Rex's question, of course, is what does the press do about it?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, in other words, how do we know he lies? Well, we know because the press has pointed out right from the beginning when he's telling a whopper.
But many people don't believe the press.
People don't believe, and our credibility is low.
Even if they believe it.
And so do you keep hitting it and therefore alienate that huge segment of the population that supports him because people become even more stuck in their point of view if you challenge it with assertions to the contrary?
Well, what are you supposed to do? I mean, look, you guys are the editors. You know, I run a news gathering organization here, too. You have to do what's right. You just have to do what's right. You can't say, if I tell the story, there'll be more people on his side if I'm telling this story. I think you just have to do what's
absolutely
right.
Absolutely. The only answer to this is to perform journalism as you were taught to perform it and to be accurate and to point out errors when you know there are errors. And, you know, it's easy for me to say because I don't get a paycheck from a newspaper anymore, but it may hurt your business, as you suggest, if readers start leaving you, but they've already started leaving us. And so we need to stand up, have some spine, and hope that we're proving that we're doing the right thing. And lo and behold, maybe people will come back. And as we've seen since the election, I think the number is now 131,000 new subscriptions that the New York Times has generated since Trump was elected.
And they owe him that because he's the one who said that they were failing.
ProPublica, the president of ProPublica was on the other day on one of the programs. He says they normally generate about $500,000 a year in donations. They've received $600,000 since the election. They were helped by John Oliver on HBO, who was suggesting people donate to a raft of causes because you've got to feel like you can do something.
Hmm.
But if a news organization rolls over, it will die, and shame on them.
Marty Baron, the editor of the Washington Post, who is best known because of his depiction in the movie Spotlight when he was the editor of the Boston Globe. Marty Baron received an award last week and said, "You will be remembered for standing up. You must stand up and declare truth." This is what you guys are saying. And you do that, he pointed out, in such ways as, for example, when Mr. Trump said that there were millions of illegal votes cast in three states that Hillary Clinton won, the headline in the New York Times said, in effect, used the word without substantiation.
He said, I think they use the word baseless.
Baseless, yes. Yeah. Trump's baseless claim. And if you declare that in the lead and in the headline, it will annoy people, but it is truth-telling. It is truth-telling, and we have to be based on fact. I think a difficulty also is going to come if Mr. Trump pursues policies contrary to fact in terms of global climate change, because we know what science is doing here. And 10 years ago at the Times Union, I told our reporters, we don't want to give fully equal weight to the climate change deniers who are standing contrary to science. As
it's
journalists,
like the Holocaust deniers, right, exactly.
It's exactly like that. And yet, if you have government policy that denies the reality of science, that is very difficult to deal with.
So let me ask you guys a question. We only have a couple of minutes. But if the country was so severely divided on this election that a lot of people are still writing me, calling me, telling me, what do I do? I'm so depressed. I can't get up in the morning. And the other day, I get an email from somebody who said, you had one commentator among all the commentators you have, a guy named Herb London, who's an arch-conservative who I don't agree with, who is talking about why, well, in this case, it's a little bit more difficult, but why we're not reporting more on the Arab stance and less on Israel. And until you kick Herb London off your air, you won't get a dime from me. You know, basically, that's a fascist approach. But I bet we're getting more of it now than we've ever had.
The answer has to be, we hate to see you go.
If that's the answer.
Yeah, I mean, if you believe that you're doing the right thing, if a newspaper editor publishes a story that says Trump's claims were baseless, that's the right thing to do. You've got to be able to sleep with yourself.
And you have to be clear about things. We have a very bright young copy editor who came to me last week with a question that has since then become widely discussed in journalism circles, and that is the term alt-right.
Yeah,
because Steve Bannon becoming the head White House strategist coming from this alt-right publication. And now the Associated Press has actually come up with a style, because alt-right is something of a whitewash.
No pun intended.
Yeah, because you're really talking about racism, white supremacism, misogyny. Alt-right is a term that has been used to sort of clean up the image of some of these
publications. Well, but don't you think we all understand what the word... I mean, I think it's a curse, to tell you the truth. And what's interesting about it is that there's a newspaper in Schenectady that has just started called The Alt.
Bad timing. A free circulation so-called alternative publication, The Alt, yes.
But it is true. I think, if I heard you correctly, Alan, I do not believe that most people know what alt-right means, and I think it needs to be explained, or a different phrase needs to be employed, because it really does, again, whitewash what this group is all about.
Well, see, I don't agree with you guys. I think amongst the people I talk to these days, they all understand what alt-right is.
We work in different circles.
There are a lot of people in this country
who don't pay that close attention.
Intelligent public radio listeners, you know, you've got the left-wing intelligentsia.
On behalf of the left-wing intelligentsia, I want to thank you.
And don't forget what Trump says. He likes the uneducated.
The undereducated. By the way, if you want to share your point of view, media@wamc.org. And here's a letter from one of our listeners, Aaron. Aaron says, "This is the best show on your station." And in this age of crisis in the media, perhaps now is the time to expand the show to a full 60 minutes.
It's all you, Rex.
But it came the week after Rex wasn't here.
And it's all on Rex. It's all Rex's responsibility, because everybody knows the only reason we don't go to an hour is because of Rex.
Yeah. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we thank you for your patronage, as they say. Isn't that right?
Right.
Ira Fussfeld, Alan Chartok, and Rex Smith, thanks for joining us this week on The Media Project.
Now you remember Mrs. Sadie Smuggery. She wanted money to buy a new fur coat. To get insurance, she employed skullduggery. She up and cut her husband's only throat. She chopped him into fragments, she stuffed him in a trunk. She shipped it all back yonder to her uncle in Podunk. Now newspapermen meet such interesting people. It must have startled poor old Sadie's unk. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, city desk. Hold the press, extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, city desk, full press.